You're listening to a podcast. You probably are listening to it on your phone. It was probably downloaded onto your phone in some kind of podcast app. Maybe you searched for this episode and downloaded it, or maybe it showed up in your feed and downloaded itself like it does every Monday. Either way, you're listening to it. You probably listen to a lot of podcasts, but since you listen to this one, you probably listen to a lot of music, too. You probably subscribe to Apple Music, or Spotify, or Amazon Music, or YouTube Music, or Tidal, I guess. You probably have a music library that's full of music you love. Maybe there are tunes in there that you've never heard. Some songs you maybe will never get around to. It's no big deal either way. You can add and remove music from your library anytime you want. It's easy. It's simple. And even if you don't subscribe to one of these streaming platforms, there's always YouTube. The point is, you have millions upon millions of songs available to you. Mere tip-taps away. 24/7, 365. It's all right there on your phone. Everything is right there on your phone. Every single thing in this entire world is there on your phone, in the palm of your hand, right now. I have grown to hate this. Cue up a little royalty-free prestige podcast, This American Life, background music, and continue. I have grown to hate this. I've grown to yearn for something else, something different, something better, I think. Something that we used to have, not even that long ago, actually. A rectangular electronic device with a screen and buttons and a charging port, a lot like the device you're probably holding right now. A lot like it, but in many ways, nothing like it. It's better. And by the time you've finished this episode, you might agree with me. This is the romance of the iPod. This is Ear Buddies. Ear Buddies Army, gather around. Welcome to another episode of our beloved podcast. A solo episode. You got Timmy on the mic. And I am, of course, happy to do these solo episodes when my pal Matt is busy. He's tied up. Can't always make it to the mic. I get it. I understand. But I will admit, once a guy becomes dependent, I guess, on near constant affirmations from a buddy, it is kind of hard to go without them. So I've deduced a solution. I have extracted several such affirmations of Matt's from prior episodes of Ear Buddies, and I will use them to just prop myself up a little bit, scatter them throughout the episode for my own benefit. So let's get to it. You know that it's all about the tunes here at Ear Buddies. And, you know, we also sometimes tackle some of that insidery industry buzz. You know, we talk about, like, the royalty formula for Spotify, things like this. But it is always in service of the tunes. And I don't know if we've ever actually talked about, like, the physical devices that we use to listen to tunes, the hardware. That is a little bit new for us, and it's the kind of esoterica that you can only get from a solo episode. So, we're talking, of course, about the iPod.
Hard to disagree with that, Tim.
Thank you, buddy. But before we begin, this episode is not coming from a place of nostalgia. You know that that's not what Matt and Tim like to do, with the pain of the old wound, as they say. That's not what this is. Over the next 23 to 28 minutes, I plan to prove to you that the very best time to be a consumer of music was exactly between November 10th, 2001 and September 5th, 2007. And I will prove this with facts and logic and science. Those dates represent two really important moments in music history, and we're going to talk about them at length. And we'll start with the first one, November 10th, 2001, which is the day that Apple releases the very first iPod. Oh, picture it, folks. I know you can. The clean white frame, the stainless steel back, the smooth rounded corners. Oh, the click wheel, the scroll wheel in the middle. Come on. I can see you as a silhouette with white earbuds on a colored background dancing in my mind's eye. Because it's beautiful, this device. It's beautiful. And I want to talk about why it's beautiful. And to do that, of course, we need context. We love context, of course. The iPod did not fall out of a coconut tree, after all. And, you know, the MP3 player, it had been around for a long time. It was not very popular before the iPod, but the MP3 player as a concept dates back, I mean, like into the 90s, I think even the 80s. And, you know, more popularly, CD players, cassette players. There were plenty of ways to carry our music around with us. So it's not like Steve Jobs and Apple, gave us fire, gave man fire, or invented the wheel or anything. But it's all about timing. And the thing that was happening in 2001, when Apple announced and released the iPod, the thing that was happening was file sharing.
I'm with, okay, pal. This is, I believe, the right tree to be barking up.
Thank you, buddy. I totally agree. So Napster and LimeWire and Kazaa and Morpheus and BearShare, all these programs that would give you songs and occasionally viruses. You remember, this was the Wild West of computing and digital music. So Napster, you know, it explodes. It's this organic, you know, person-to-person movement that creates out of whole cloth a digital music industry that did not exist before that. You know, you would simply buy your CD, and if you were tech savvy, maybe you would rip those songs onto your computer and use some lousy software to listen to it with, like, a visualizer, you know, sort of sound wave thing. Things were not that sophisticated around the turn of the millennium. And so Napster and other file sharing services, programs, changed the way that we, you know, associate music with computers. And it was up to the brands of the world, you know, the real life legal above board brands, to catch up to what was happening in this Wild West space. And the visionaries at Apple just so happened to be the ones to do it first. And my tongue is mostly in my cheek when I use the word visionaries, right? I don't think that Steve Jobs and the rest of the board at Apple could have actually known, like, what the ripple effects would be by releasing the iPod into the world. But even if they couldn't see our very, very connected future, they were certainly savvy about what was happening in the present at that time. So this takes us to January of 2001. We still don't have an iPod, but we do have something new from Apple called iTunes.
It allows you to have libraries of music. It allows you to rip CDs. It allows you to create playlists. And it allows you to burn CDs all in one integrated application.
So iTunes is just, it's software, right? That at the time was only available on Macs, which not many people had. But it allowed you to organize your music library, the songs that you obtained illegally, or the songs you ripped from your discs. You could sort them, and you could shuffle them, and you could do all these things in kind of an easier to use than before way. So here's Apple kind of starting to meet this digital music need. And then later in the year, Apple announces something else. So this takes us to October of 2001. And you've got this, picture it, folks. You've got an auditorium full of nerds, full of tech bros. All these guys in their button-ups, and they've got their lanyards, and they're all sitting there dying to know what Steve Jobs is going to say. And out he comes, and he's got his blue jeans and his turtleneck, and he introduces us to what he calls a hard drive jukebox player.
What is iPod? iPod is an MP3 music player, has CD quality music, but the biggest thing about iPod is it holds 1,000 songs. Now, this is a.
And he pulls the iPod out of his pocket. He shows it to the tech dudes, and they all love it. They all go bananas. And that takes us to the first date that I mentioned, November 10th, 2001. The iPod goes on sale. And with it begins the very best period of time to be a music consumer.
Just want to say, I'm with you. Please continue.
Thank you, buddy. I will. So you can call it a slow start. There's excitement around this thing, but it only works with Mac, and it's a little expensive. And in 2002, they sell about 400,000 iPods. And the next year, it's close to 1 million. And then the next year, it's 4 million. And then the next year, in 2005, it's 22 million. And this thing is blowing up. It goes from a niche device, a gadget for just the cool guys and Apple weirdos, to this like truly ubiquitous thing. It, you know, tastemakers and trendsetters are buying it, and you start to get those dancing silhouette commercials, right? It blows up. I would assume way beyond the expectations of Steve J and the rest of the crew at Apple. By 2014, Apple has sold 400 million iPods. And they've got all kinds of versions at this point, right? They've got the iPod Mini, and then the Nano, and a version that can play video on the tiny little screen. There's a version that is black and red and associated with U2. And at first, you know, the very first iPod holds 1,000 songs. But, you know, the hard drives get, the technology gets better. Eventually, it's able to hold like 20,000 songs. And it explodes. It is an undeniable sales juggernaut for Apple. And it kind of turns that company around a little bit. Suddenly, like, everything they make is cool. And it gets crazier, guys. A couple years into the lifespan of the iPod, in 2003, Apple launches the iTunes Store, which for the first time ever is selling music online for 99 cents a song, and you could get a whole album for 10 bucks or whatever. And think about that. Think about it. In 2003, that's the first time that you can legally buy music from major labels on a computer. It feels crazy now, but that's how it was. And that blows up. The iTunes Store, in its first year, sells 100 million songs. And let's use 2014 as our marker here again. 35 billion songs sold in the iTunes Store by 2014. Humana, humana.
Oh, and how?
So with all this, all these products and apps and services, Apple ushers in this modern, legal, digital music landscape. And it kind of opens Pandora's box in the process, in my opinion. And I will talk about that more in a little bit. But first, why do I call this episode The Romance of the iPod? Let me tell you why. Come close. Lean in. It's because when I got my iPod in, I think it was 2004, my world just blew wide open. Because the timing of the rise of the MP3 player was perfect for me. It coincides with, you know, my turning into like a real person with autonomy and taste and interests, right? I'm 13 or I'm 14 years old. I'm in middle school and developing my own musical tastes apart from what was presented to me when I'm a kid or, you know, what's around me thanks to my parents or my older siblings or what have you. And this is a formative time. Like, you know, the choices that you make, the flags you plant in artists or genres as a young person around that like 13, 14 year old age, I think really help shape what you're into as an adult. And I'm learning about Coldplay. These are crucial years for me. And I'm listening to the radio and I'm honing my tastes and friends are burning me CDs with their favorite songs and I'm figuring out what I like and what I dislike. And all of this engagement, this fresh, young, you know, eager engagement with music is happening on my iPod. You know, I'm being thoughtful about the songs that I rip off CDs and add to the library. Every song was in its place. Like, this is one of the big things for me. Every song was there for a reason. I either downloaded it for a dollar on iTunes, or pulled it off a CD that a friend gave me, or I obtained it through some other means. But however it happened, there was purpose behind it. So I spend time with these songs. I let them sink their teeth into me. I dive deeply into genres that I'm interested in. Because the list is finite by necessity, but you know, the nature of the device is you can't carry that much music with you, so you have to make decisions about what do you want? What do you like? What's important to you? You know, at the beginning of this episode, I described this as the very best time to be a consumer of music. Why did I say that? Because I believe the iPod gave us this perfect Goldilocks zone of access and curation.
Yes, what, buddy? 100%.
Thank you, buddy. I'll explain what I mean. Access, because you know you're no longer limited by what fits onto a CD. You're not tethered to a computer desk either. The iPod gave you portability, and it gave you a pretty decent amount of space. 1,000 songs is a lot. I mean, it's not a ton by today's standards, but if you compare it to the technology that came before it, it was a huge leap. But crucially, there is a ceiling. And yeah, the ceiling gets higher with each new iPod every year. But regardless of hard drive space, this thing is not connected to the internet. It's the era before streaming music, so you had the songs that you had and nothing else. So you have to curate. You have to be careful and considerate of what you want to listen to and then obtain it somehow and then go enjoy it. And I truly believe that those two elements, that miracle of portability and the requirement of curation, created this gold standard of music consumption. But nothing gold can stay. So back to Pandora's box. The iPod is spiraling out of control in terms of growth. By 2007, they sell 51 million iPods just in that year. And then Apple takes it to the next step. They say, what if you could do even more with your iPod? What if it started to feel like a cell phone? And so you get the iPod Touch, which is released into the world on September 5th, 2007, which is the second date I mentioned, officially ending the Goldilocks zone, in my opinion. It is still an iPod, but it has Wi-Fi, right? So you can get on the internet. You can go on YouTube. You can download songs from the iTunes store right there. You can play solitaire. You could make it look like you were drinking a mug of beer with that app that you'd tip over, right? You remember? So we're pushing out of this Goldilocks zone. The iPod is no longer just one device for one purpose. It's a device for many purposes. And of course, it evolves into the iPhone. And the understanding of what these devices do gets blurrier and blurrier and broader. You know, your phone that you have today is really not that different from that first iPod Touch in 2007. I mean, obviously it has an antenna so you can talk on the phone and send texts and everything. The internet, carrying the internet around on a device, I mean, that's the key here. And in the music industry, the major difference is streaming services.
Yes.
The era of streaming changes everything, honestly. Spotify broke the chokehold that the iTunes store had on this industry by just giving people everything. And you can even do it for free with ads. But, you know, the flat monthly fee essentially makes your music feel free, makes all music feel free, you know, minus the credit card transaction once a month. So Apple follows suit, you know, chasing Spotify. We get Apple Music and we get Tidal and everything else. You know how it is now. I mean, you know how it is now. It's everything is on demand. Everything is a subscription now. That's the business model that has swallowed up the music industry and pretty much every other industry, too. So it can feel difficult to remember how things were before. And it's also easy to forget that there was not unanimous support for moving to the subscription model. In fact, our very favorite subject on this podcast, our muse, Taylor Swift, used as much influence as she possibly could back in 2014 to resist this. She literally wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal saying that, like, streaming is not the way forward. She said, quote, "It's my opinion that music should not be free, and my prediction is that individual artists and their labels will someday decide what an album's price point is. I hope they don't underestimate themselves or undervalue their art," end quote. I mean, a nice thought, Taylor, but there was no stopping this train. Let me give you some facts and figures here, folks. Back in 2013, paid subscriptions like Spotify made up 9% of the music industry revenue. That 9% is now 65%. Streaming absolutely gobbled up every other way we consume music. So for all intents and purposes, Taylor could not stop this train. You know, her music is up for streaming. That's how it works now. This is how we live now. We have everything everywhere all at once, I suppose.
Absolutely, yes. Yes.
So let me start wrapping up here. In December of last year, a photo went viral on X, formerly Twitter. And I want to describe that photo to you now. It's a low-resolution image of an old computer hutch, like from the 90s or the early 2000s. Picture it, right? A slide-out tray for your computer, keyboard, and mouse, and the big, gigantic, square computer monitor in the middle that, you know, is 50 pounds, and a tower for the computer on the right, and a big stack of CD-ROMs, and a printer, and speakers, and drawers, and everything. And the photo is captioned, quote, "There was a time when we respected the computer," end quote. And that's good. That's funny. 35,000 faves. Good stuff. But a quote tweet of this image is still haunting me, and I want to read this to you now. Quote, "It was kind of nice when the internet was a single, solitary, unmoving place instead of a terror that extends to everywhere. You went to this specific spot to go to the internet. When you left the spot, you left the internet. It was a place," end quote. Oh, man. This idea of finite connectivity. I mean, it's gone, right? It vanished so quickly that I didn't notice really when it happened. And the genie, as they say, is out of the bottle. Like, we can't ever be apart from the internet now in life. It is all around us. We all carry devices in our pocket that can connect us to everybody anytime. Our friends and family expect it. You know, it's important. It has become kind of an essential part of having a social life or a work life in many cases. A lot of workplaces say, you know, we need to be able to reach you at any time, even if you're off the clock, right? And, you know, we're also never without entertainment from our streaming platforms and our subscriptions. We can have anything we want. Any song ever recorded, any movie is streaming somewhere at this point. And we don't own anything anymore, which is, you know, that's just par for the course. We pay for access, and if we stop paying, then we essentially have nothing. And I understand, everyone. I'm beginning to sound like a Luddite. It sounds like I am an old man yelling at iCloud. Right. I understand. I know. And I recognize that there are all kinds of conveniences and perks and benefits that come with life as we have it now. And I will say, I'm sure that the scientists and the whatnots are doing research and have said a thing or two about how smartphones are rewiring our brains and our attention spans. And I am not going to dive into that. This is a music podcast, right? But you know that feeling, if you've ever broken your phone or lost it or something, and you're suddenly without a smart device, and the internet is suddenly back in just one place, like it was in the 90s or the 2000s, that is a foreign feeling, and it's strange and kind of unpleasant. And when I think about the iPod now, I think about that strange feeling of just having one device that did my one thing. And I do feel wistful. I do feel the pain of that old wound. To me, the romance of the iPod is a long-lost romance. It was fleeting. It's a fond memory that I can never return to. None of us can ever return to this. It was nice while we had it. And selfishly, I'm glad I had it when I did in my life. But I can't have it again. Oh man, am I really... Is this honestly how I'm going to end this episode? I think it is. Sorry, gang, what a bummer. Okay, I'll try to end with a little bit of lightness. I will leave you with some classic iPod click wheel ASMR. And I will mix in some more royalty-free prestige podcast music. And I'll say that I am glad that you're here with me. Glad you're in the army. Glad we're doing this together, all of us. Matt's back next week. Until then, talk to you later, buddies. Bye-bye.